to stop people from becoming radicalized. Yet these very same service members need to be the role models for the rest to follow. Far-right extremism in the UK military and service members, the subject of this edition of The Debate.
Armed Forces' allure for far-right extremists is believed to be as old as British fascism's earliest incarnations. At least 16 members of the country's armed forces investigated over the past 2.5 years have been referred to the UK's so-called PREVENT scheme, a controversial terrorism prevention program.
The British Army is seen as being a defence of Britain and British values, but those British values are rooted in racism, as I say, and also in its history of colonialism and empire. The British military is in itself a racist institution because Britain is a racist society.
The UK Ministry of Defence is yet to release exact figures, but it says the number of investigations in 2020 was less than 10, and those so far this year, less than 5. Critics say, despite the MOD's stated commitment to zero tolerance for far-right extremists operating within the armed forces, its strong words have not always led to strong action.
Of course the British government's going to say there's a zero tolerance policy, but that is nothing in keeping with the reality when it comes to the culture that exists within the British Army, because of its role, because of its history, because of its legacy, and because of its identity. The far right is on the march, not just in the UK, but throughout the West. This is a result of the socio-economic problems ushered in by the 2008 economic collapse, and the far right have been able to point the fingers at migrants and refugees and existing minority communities as being the problem. I think that this is just the tip of the iceberg. I think it goes far, far deeper, and I think there's a cover-up abroad in consequence.
Of the 14 investigations carried out in 2019 into serving armed forces personnel, a staggering 11 stemmed from far-right concerns. And those concerns have been fueled by images such as this one from 2019, British paratroopers using pictures of former Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn for target practice, or this video from a year earlier of notorious far-right English Defence League founder known as Tommy Robinson surrounded by a group of young infantrymen.
Last year, the UK's top counter-terrorism officer said the fastest-growing UK terrorist threat came from the far right. A year later, the threat is still there, with critics saying the government is not taking the threat seriously enough. Saeed Pourriza, London.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Debate, Ian Williams, is senior analyst at Foreign Policy and Focus, joining us from New York. We also have Saeed Mohsin Abbas, who's a journalist and political commentator, joining us from London. Welcome to you both. Saeed Mohsin Abbas, let me first start with you. Let me ask a general question first, in terms of the UK as a whole. Does the UK have a problem with far-right groups and extreme or far-right ideology?
It certainly does have a problem with far-right. Of course, the coronavirus and COVID-19 have kind of overtaken the headlines. That doesn't mean that such organizations don't exist or have stopped operating. Far from it. It was very clear that these organizations were now at the stage of becoming militarily and, arms-wise, completely ready to take various action. And we've seen evidence of violent extremism of that kind across Europe. But in England, whilst it hasn't manifested in a mass killing as such, what has happened is the rallies that these organisations, like the EDL, you know, the English Defence League, and various others, have begun to get more and more nasty and vicious. I know journalists, seasoned journalists, who've dealt with this issue, racism, the far right, and the kind of violent far right, if you like. They've been dealing with them for decades. Around last year, one of those journalists very openly confided in me and said, look, it's no longer safe for me to actually go to the rallies and the demonstrations because these people have gone to another level and I'm worried about my life. She was seriously saying that actually she felt threatened in terms of her own life by becoming too, if you like, engaging with these far-right organizations. That's the state of the rallies and those gatherings. Can you imagine behind the scenes what may be going on in terms of the organization, the planning, the strategic directions that they might be receiving? And what worries me even more is that this climate of hate, which has been created by not just far-right organizations, but rather by the British media, by British institutions, the political institutions themselves, which are overtly racist and Islamophobic, Boris Johnson. You only have to recall his statements around women in letterboxes for women who wear niqabs, for instance, to give you an indication of just how Islamophobic and racist the leadership itself is at the moment. Well, as it filters down into the more the nasty elements, of course, that sentiment becomes one of action. The military, of course, is a place where people could get trained. And that's what's most worrying about these figures and the inaction of the government. So, yes, Britain has a huge problem of Islamophobia, which it sweeps under the carpet. And, of course, the cutting edge of that will be the rise of these terrorist right-wing groups.
Okay. Well, let's get to that, Ian Williams. You have soldiers, Air Force, and naval personnel who were among those that were investigated. The report covered that. It was over the course of 2.5 years under a program called PREVENT, which investigates far-right extremism and UK soldiers. Does the fact that this program was required to be launched show that there was actually a problem within the UK military personnel with radicalization?
I'm somewhat amazed that they only investigated 11 or 14. If that's the scale of the problem, then it's under control. But I don't believe that. I believe they're only investigating the most egregious examples. What struck me is that people have resurrected. There's a checklist that the army itself produced for almost 5 years ago on indicators and warnings for extreme right wing. And looking through that checklist, most of the present conservative cabinet would probably qualify. Certainly most of the American Congress would. A lot of the police would. I mean, they describe, it says that, look for individuals, it says, for people in the military who describe themselves as patriots. Look for people who describe their opponents as traitors. Look at people who use the term Islamofascism. You know, and you look at people ready to challenge their views as indoctrinated. You refer to political correctness as some left-wing or communist plot. Top marks whoever drew up this list. It's fairly effective and comprehensive, and it applies to a considerable degree of American society, British society, and newspaper editors as well. But to put this in perspective, recently something like half, I think it was, of the French gendarmerie said that they would be voting for Le Pen, you know, a descendant of the Vichy regime in Germany. They're there. So, you know, I think Britain has a problem, but I don't think it's completely unique. The question is, how do you combat it? There is always an attraction from the right wing for military uniforms and you shout patriotism. The redeeming grace in the British Army is that they can't get enough recruits.
Well, let me jump in here, Ian Williams. I'd like to find out from you, because I'd like to actually have you clarify this. Is it in terms of the attraction? Is it coming from, as you mentioned, the far-right groups who are going after military personnel, or are military personnel attracted to the far-right ideology, and then they become radicalized? Because there is a difference here.
Now, I think they're mutually reinforcing processes. You know, Britain's never had a real tradition of idolatry for the military the way that the Americans have, for example. If you go to Britain and say, I'm a veteran, they say, so? You're retired? What's your problem? You know, the veterans are not put on a pedestal. If somebody said, I serve, they say, so? There's a sort of pragmatic attitude that doesn't glorify the military, despite the best efforts of the Sun, the Express, and the rest of the press. The military are more a normal part of society. But it is getting complicated by the fact that it's been 40 years since there was conscription in Britain. It's a professional army. People volunteer to join, you know, the forces in general. And the military, the actual army tends to be less skilled, let us say. You need a degrees of skill to be a sailor or an air forceman. And these are people who very likely couldn't get jobs elsewhere, and they're recruited. They tend to come from those sectors of society which tend to that those views anyway. But I've got to say, I've been with the British military and other militaries on UN peacekeeping forces, you know, reporting, And I've never seen really overt racism, casual racism of the kind that I expected, frankly. Partly because they're so mixed in themselves. Unless you're in the top guards regiments, it reflects the society, which is a multi-ethnic one. But yes, there have been lots of reports of real racism against the two paratroopers. One a court case on discrimination a year or so ago because of the racist treatment they were getting. I think the real issue is whether the officers and the military establishment take it serious enough to combat it, and they don't nudge and wink at it. But it's bound to be a serious problem. And remember, this is the military that some of whose members were alleged to be plotting a coup against Harold Wilson, because he was such a left-wing prime minister.
We're going to get pragmatic
social democrat ever, and the military will work with newspaper proprietors.
Well, we're going to get to some examples of some of these military personnel in a second. But it's interesting, Ian Williams, that you say, could the figures actually be higher? You kind of posed that question, and say, Mohsen Abbas, I'd like to expand on that, because it seems like it is, based on Nick Lowles, who's Hope Not Hate's chief executive. He has said the referrals of so many serving military personnel to prevent the program, and general rise, then he went on to say, of violent far-right extremism in society as a whole. So that right there kind of points to the fact that the numbers couldn't just be 14 cases. So this could be a lot higher. Do you think that they're trying to conceal this figure, limiting it to it being reported to just 14 cases?
Inevitably, institutions will cover their own back. I think it's inevitable that, you know, institutions in Britain or anywhere across the West that I know would try to suppress or deflect or cover up the kind of endemic institutionalized racism that exists within them. I mean, the Met Police here have been caught out so many times. Statistics exist left, right, and center. It's not been resolved. It's not been dealt with in an adequate manner. The British military is no different. I think it's just even probably more secretive and even more capable of making excuses to cover these things up in the in the national interest, I would imagine. But look, we know for a fact, of course, that as my colleague said, the kind of people that do get recruited in the lower ranks of the British Army, they come from the kind of backgrounds where they're not exactly going to be blessed with great knowledge or history, historical knowledge of either the areas they go to, or nor is it actually probably part of their training. I've dealt with the British military at one level. They do have a section which deals with cultural, issues, so that the soldiers could better adapt to environments like Afghanistan, for instance, or Iraq, or all the umpteenth number of other places which essentially NATO, the British, the Americans have been going and spreading their own particular form of democracy. As we know, across the Muslim world, we've been blessed with British, American, and other troops coming in to give us democracy, give them supposedly human rights, peace initiatives. What tends to end up happening is brutal war and the indiscriminate killing of civilians on an absolutely industrial scale, whether it's in Iraq, Afghanistan, and beyond. Millions have been subject to that kind of process. Uh-huh. Now, the soldiers that go there, of course, their job is not to empathize or sympathize. It's there to do the job that they're given to do. Now, that job is essentially to, at the extreme end, kill people. That's what the job of an army is. And the kind of people that you recruit to do that really don't ask too many questions. So the blowback from such an ongoing, imperialist or British / American, I call it Anglo imperialism across the entire Muslim world, in particular, or the Middle East, essentially, to protect the British interests, has been all about being brutal, really, and all about being very cold, callous in the interests of British economics, policy, or the politics. So,
okay,
these soldiers really are part and parcel of a machine which is creating blowback the blowback, which can come back to Britain in many, many shapes and forms. And of course, when you've got a society which has been groomed now on the idea of ISIS and Islam being one and the same, terrorism in our own capitals here in the West being linked directly to Muslims, migrants, as was mentioned earlier, and add to that such things as Brexit and the nationalism of the Scots. There is a growing environment of if you like, hatred and fear and, right. and insularity, which I think can be taken advantage of by anybody inside institutions or outside British institutions.
Well, let's talk about a case here that is pretty jaw-dropping in Williams, and it involves two naval personnel, which included one who was due to work on a Trident nuclear submarine, and they were exposed as members of the far-right identitarian movement. It's a movement which has links to a banned terrorist organization. I'm just, you know, I'm curious as to how, what kind of vetting process could there have been, or what kind of, how could that
well, they
go
were
under
found,
the radar?
So the vetting process is there and working. Look, if these right groups wanted to go deep undercover, they wouldn't allow their infiltrators to show their colors in public like that. This is, if you remember, the Bolsheviks infiltrated the Tsarist army, which is one of the reasons for the Russian Revolution. they subverted the army. You know, it's if people want power, they can infiltrate people in there. That one of the pluses of Britain is that the army has relatively been out of politics. We haven't mentioned, but we also have to consider the deleterious effect of 30 or 40 years of the troubles in Ireland, where the army was involved in secret undercover activities and was actually, fighting against what, on the face of it, were their own people. Because if you want to be callous about it, it's one thing for them to go out to the Empire and shoot up people in Arden and Cyprus and Kenya. It's when they come back and transfer those activities back home that it becomes, how should we say, a threat to the body politic. I'm not saying it's good, but when the army gets used to shooting their own people and infiltrating
right.
their own people and taking part in active politics in their own political system, as they did in Ireland, that is a very worrying trend. And, it doesn't in any way condone the overt racism about ethnic minorities, but the Irish thing has really twisted the British force, the British army. Because the Air Force and Navy weren't involved that much.
I got two important questions to ask, but I unfortunately have a couple minutes here on Saint Mohsen Abbas. I'm going to take this one question, which shook the entire UK, and that was when the British police officer who was charged with the murder of Sarah Everard, if you remember that, I'm sure. You know, you have a police officer that mentally somehow something went wrong. So I'm curious, this is the type of radicalization that is a result of perhaps the psyche, the UK service member or police in this case, psyche, going into that radicalization, being brainwashed in a sense to be that way, which results in this type of incident. Is that a deduction that can be made?
I think that there's far more evidence, as I said, on the ground of people who are prepared to do things. But of course, we live in an era now where these fellows are technologically literate. They're being developed, arguably also by strategists from across Europe. It's even possible, and this has been mooted by certain circles, allegedly, that actually even deep state, British deep state itself, is allowing some of these groups to continue their activities, and they know perfectly well that they're armed and ready. But actually, these sort of right-wing groups could serve a purpose, and in fact, they're allowed to continue because they counteract certain other forces in society. So this notion that MI6, MI5, and the security services don't know about these organizations and can't shut them down, to me, is incredible. I think that they could easily hunt down all of these groups and pick them up and pretty much shut down the whole situation. I mean, the fact that a Lance Corporal in 2018, Mikko Rivalinen, I think, joined a group called the neo-Nazi, well, it's a neo-Nazi group, National Action, and still joined the army, is a worrying sign. But actually, it's the ones who are covert and who haven't showed themselves to be within these kind of racist, overtly racist and violently extreme organizations that are more worrying, because I think there's a huge underbelly of those folk who are ready to take action against British citizens and beyond.
Okay. I can squeeze in a 30-second answer to you, Ian Williams. My other question has to deal with the way that the UK has actually defined this whole extremism, its definition, which some are saying is controversial and weak in terms of the way that it has defined it. The current government's been decried as unfit for purpose, some have said, with some far-right groups even using it to their advantage. Is that the case? 30 seconds.
Yes, they are looking after it. What our enemy here is lack of transparency and impunity for the security forces and the police forces. The idea that they can do whatever they like and they're not subject to scrutiny and their personnel will get an easy ride. It's the same as the police departments in the US. It's the same with the security services everywhere in the world.
Unfortunately, I got to jump in here. We're just fresh out of time. That's Ian Williams talking there, senior analyst at Foreign Policy and Focus. Thank you. And Saibal Sinabas, thank you so much, journalist and political commentator. And that does it for this edition of Debate. For Mikhail Taiwe and the entire team in the capital of Taiwan, it's goodbye until next time.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by the Iraqi alim or scholar and speaker, Sayyid Hashim al-Haydari. Please stay tuned.
هذا تحدث به سماحة الإمام القائد بالأمس أن فلسطين ستتحرر.
This was already discussed by our leader Imam Khamenei that Palestine will be liberated and this is a divine celestial promise. Everybody must take part in it. In the virtual space, forums, protests, hashtagging, Facebook, Instagram, and etc. Anything that can expressly fill this space. I mean, the cyberspace. In the universities, we have to remind each other and talk in a company, in the workplace or in the streets. We may hang up some posters, "Death to Israel, Palestine will be free," or "We are willing to confront Israel," and such slogans. Therefore, we as Muslims, our test and obligation today is the case of Palestine, the support for Al-Quds in any possible way. America does not care about anything but Israel. This is why we in the Persian Gulf or anywhere in Asia should not believe nor trust America. We must act against America, especially after this crime of America against Al-Quds, which is of the axiom and sanctities of the Muslims. So we ought to not to trust America. America is the great Satan and the mother of corruption.
Thank you so much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by the Iraqi Ulama and scholar and speaker Sayyid Hashim Al-Haytham. Until next time, we leave you in Allah's care.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Around the world with reporters.
After the Israeli airstrike hit Al-Kolak family building in the Gaza Strip, Zainab Al-Kolak was rescued by the civil defense after spending 12 hours under the rubble of her home. Zainab survived, but at least 30 members of her family were killed by the Israeli raid in the latest escalation against Gaza. After repeated failures to extricate her from the rubble, rescue workers finally saved Zainab Al-Kolak, a 22-year-old Palestinian woman who lost her family members in an Israeli airstrike on their house in the Gaza Strip.
We all gathered in a room watching news, and I was using my phone. We heard two missiles hitting somewhere really close. We heard bombing before, but this one was different, and the home was shaking. We got really scared, and we even forgot to take our bags of important things that we prepared for any possible bombing. My mom and my only sister were next to me. The last thing I remember was everyone scared and didn't know what was happening. The roof fell on our heads. In less than a second, I found myself under the rubble.
Stuck under the rubble, Zainab used her cell phone and called the Gaza ambulance service, hoping they could help her and save her family. But it took hours until they saved her from the rubble because Israeli regime destroyed the main roads leading to her home and the hospital.
I was holding my phone while trapped under the rubble. The voices of my mom and sister just disappeared, and I started to call people. I don't know how I remembered the numbers of civil defense. I called them, but they couldn't reach me. I started to call my friends, Shaima and Fatima, but I wasn't able to tell them I was under the rubbles. I spent 12 hours there. I just imagined that when I called the civil defense, they would save us fast, but it took long to reach us, and eventually I lost the hope to stay alive.
Zainab, who studies English literature and is interested in arts, expressed that no words can describe her feeling of losing her family. While Zainab's father is still at hospital receiving treatment, Zainab is now worried about her new burdens and responsibilities after losing her mother.
This is not the first time Israel has done such a massacre. We lived our lives just between one war and another. We thought we were safe, but no one is. They hit us with no prior notice. We were a big family, and now I can count us on one hand. I used to be a normal student, and now I have millions of things to take care of as life throws me in the middle of everything.
Zainab and her family members are not the only victims of the Israeli attacks. 11 days of Israeli air, land, and sea assaults on Gaza killed 255 Palestinians, including 66 children. The strikes also wounded more than 1,900 people before a ceasefire went into effect on May the 21st. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
The International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA's latest report on Iran is the first since the country stopped implementing voluntary transparency measures as a result of a law passed by Parliament restricting agency access to nuclear facilities. Under a temporary agreement between Tehran and the IAEA valid until the 24th of June, the agency will continue to collect data at Iran's key nuclear facilities via its surveillance equipment, but will not be able to access that data. Iran's envoy to the IAEA, Kazem Gharibabadi, said the agency had no access that had previously been provided under the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA.
The verification and monitoring activities that the agency had in our nuclear facilities based on the JCPOA, as the Director General reflected in his report, actually all those areas have been stopped and the agency didn't have any kind of access in accordance with the JCPOA to our nuclear sites and also the nuclear activities in the nuclear facilities.
In his report, IAEA Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi estimated Iran's stockpile of enriched uranium to be about 16 times higher than the limit set in the deal. Gharibabadi said Iran is continuing to enrich uranium at the level of 5, 20 and 60%. The limit set in the deal was 3.67%.
There is no suspension in the nuclear activities, such as installation of production, installation of new machines, and also the enrichment level and the stockpile. So it is very important that actually these kind of activities have not been affected even due to the nuclear negotiation that we have around the JCPOA in Vienna nowadays.
Iran stepped back from its nuclear commitments in response to the previous U.S. administration's withdrawal from the deal and the reimposition of sanctions.
Negotiations to revive the deal have been taking place in Vienna since April, with Tehran standing firm on its position. It will only return to full compliance after the U.S. has removed all sanctions in a verifiable manner. Homa Lizki, Vienna.
After months of despair, and a battle against the COVID-19 pandemic, a ray of hope has emerged in several parts of Indian subcontinent as the second wave of the pandemic is showing signs of retreat. The new cases continue to fall for the fourth consecutive day, based on government figures. Health experts and surveys, however, suggest the figures could be 20 times higher than the official figures.
We were overwhelmed by the daily number of cremations till last week, and most of the time there was hardly any calculation. Now it seems there is a slight drop in cases. I hope things are changing now. We pray to God we never get to see such scenes again.
According to a latest study carried out by scientists at the University of Michigan, along with scholars from several institutes, the estimated COVID cases in India could be as high as 492 million till mid-May, which contradicts the Indian official figures of 24 million. The study also puts the overall death toll 4.5 times more than what is officially recorded.
We were struggling last week with the number of patients and dead bodies, and I'm sure there is no proper data about the number of deaths since India is a big country. Cities might have calculations, but there is no calculation about villages.
Many parts of the country have now started gradually opening after weeks of strict lockdowns, which has put a tremendous toll on the country's economic activity. Officials, however, have warned the pandemic is not over, urging people to follow the COVID protocol strictly. Lockdowns aimed at containing the pandemic have now inflicted a heavy toll on the country's economy. Reports suggest the South Asian nation could be headed for a double-digit unemployment rate in the coming weeks, and migrant workers are among the hardest hit. According to official figures, India has registered 28 million COVID cases so far, 25 million have recovered, and about 330,000 have died due to the pandemic. Now the country is battling acute vaccination shortage, while it aims to vaccinate 10 million adults per day from mid-July. Biggest vaccine makers have already started bidding for the contracts after states were directed to buy vaccines directly from the manufacturers. Health experts say it is a mammoth task given the country's geography and the population. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
The UK Armed Forces' allure for far-right extremists is believed to be as old as British fascism's earliest incarnations. At least 16 members of the country's armed forces investigated over the past 2.5 years have been referred to the UK's so-called PREVENT scheme, a controversial terrorism prevention program.
The British Army is seen as being a defence of Britain and British values, but those British values are rooted in racism, as I say, and also in its history of colonialism and empire. The British military is in itself a racist institution because Britain is a racist society.
The UK Ministry of Defence is yet to release exact figures, but it says the number of investigations in 2020 was less than 10, and those so far this year, less than 5. Critics say, despite the MOD's stated commitment to zero tolerance for far-right extremists operating within the armed forces, its strong words have not always led to strong action.
Of course, the British government's going to say there's a zero tolerance policy, but that is nothing in keeping with the reality when it comes to the culture that exists within the British Army because of its role, because of its history, because of its legacy, and because of its identity. The far right is on the march, not just in the UK, but throughout the West. This is a result of the socio-economic problems ushered in by the 2008 economic collapse, and the far right have been able to point the fingers at migrants and refugees and existing minority communities as being the problem. I think that this is just the tip of the iceberg. I think it goes far, far deeper, and I think there's a cover-up abroad in consequence.
Of the 14 investigations carried out in 2019 into serving armed forces personnel, a staggering 11 stem from far-right concerns. And those concerns have been fueled by images such as this one from 2019. British paratroopers using pictures of former Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn for target practice.
Last year, the UK's top counter-terrorism officer said the fastest-growing UK terrorist threat came from the far right. A year later, the threat is still there, with critics saying the government is not taking the threat seriously enough. Saeed Pariza, London.
The
the IRIB, the Broadcasting Organization of Iran. The red carpet treatment is being given to the candidates who want to contest in 13th presidential election. Several studios are hosting the seven runners who explain in detail their plans.
The economy under my administration will focus on domestic production and exports. Whatever creates obstacles on that path has to be removed, and whatever strengthens that sector must be paid attention to and boosted. One of my administration's approaches will be to use a strong foreign policy to create international markets to improve our domestic production and exports. We can make the best of the demands in countries in South America, Africa, and South Asia to achieve that end.
Zakani stressed that the next administration has to change course and rely on Iran's domestic capabilities and utilize all regional and international capacities to move towards success. The other candidate, Saeed Jalili, said Iran must not await favors from those who murdered Iranian anti-terror commander Qasem Soleimani. He also added that a wrong approach and a weak performance cannot take the country to the summits. Mohsen Rezaei also took the floor to talk to the people regarding his economic agenda.
Some people misunderstood my plans about boosting the national currency. I said we can increase the value of our currency to become the third strongest money in the region after the US dollar and euro. It means that when you go to the exchange market after the first two, Iran's rial would be exchanged the most.
Rezaei also called for reforms in Iran's insurance, banking, and stock market systems. Reformist Mohsen Mehralizadeh, who was speaking at a news network, said that the main problems of the country today are due to macro policies, and the world-known scientific models should be used to solve the problems. In the end, Mehralizadeh referred to economic problems of people, but asked them to go to the polls to use the right of democracy to solve such issues. Some 60 million Iranians are eligible to vote in the 13th presidential election, which is slated to be held on June 18th. Humana Vedi, Tehran.
Benjamin Netanyahu's 12-year reign as Israel's prime minister is much likely to end on Sunday. Naftali Bennett, a far-right politician leading Yamina Party, and Yair Lapid, a centrist and opposition leader of Yesh Atid Party, moved closer to forming a coalition after four inconclusive parliamentary elections in 2 years, and Netanyahu's repeated failure to form a coalition.
Shamati Naftali Bennett.
Netanyahu accused Bennett of trying to form a leftist ruling structure that would ensure his rise to premiership. He said that Bennett had been sowing discord, division, and hatred against him.
There are many reasons behind efforts by the Israeli parties working together to oust Netanyahu. He has always declared himself as the only leader of Israel. He has no rival even within his own party. Meanwhile, he has failed to form a coalition so far. Therefore, removing him from the political scene could serve as a strong blow on the Likud and Netanyahu himself.
Bennett said his party would work with the opposition leaders to build an alternative cabinet. Observers say the alliance between eight relatively small parties with a diffuse range of ideologies won't be easy. But if they succeed, they had agreed that the prime minister's post would rotate between Bennett, a former settler leader who rejects the concept of a sovereign Palestinian state and champions the religious right, and Lapid, who is considered a voice of secular centrists.
It's not an easy mission. We are speaking about the ideological differences between two opposition parties. That's a complex decision for Bennett. They have to tackle lots of problems before forming a cabinet. Moreover, Netanyahu won't remain silent. He may take people with right-wing tendency to the streets to hamper efforts by any future cabinet.
Netanyahu has been holding on to power for the past 12 years. His popularity has, however, suffered an unprecedented plunge among the Israelis, who have been holding regular rallies outside his residence for months on end to force him to resign. Today, experts say nothing must be taken for granted because what's being described as the anti-Netanyahu cabinet of change is still not an accomplished fact. They say Netanyahu is not simply departing the scene without a fight for remaining in office. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
South Korea is hosting the P4G Seoul Summit on Climate Change, bringing together leaders from more than 60 countries. Held both offline and online, the meeting sought, quote, inclusive green recovery toward carbon neutrality. South Korean President Moon Jae-in pledged more international aid.
We will provide more assistance to developing countries to lay tailored green growth policies. Countries have their own stages of economic development, and thus they also differ on the dependence on coal power. Certainly more assistance is needed to transition into a low-carbon economy.
Outside, critics point out that South Korea continues constructing and exporting coal-fired power plants, which generate the most CO2 emissions of all fossil fuels globally, about 30%. South Korea's pledge to end coal power financing. Climate change scientists agree that the COVID-19 pandemic and its lockdowns reduced human activity, which caused a reduction in CO2 emissions. But that reduction in climate-changing pollution will be short-lived as people drive back to work, factories reopen, and airlines resume their pre-pandemic flight schedules. As the forum took place, environmental activists marched to the venue, critical of the government's carbon record and a new green growth plan to cut down old growth forest to replant young carbon-absorbing trees.
The P4G summit talks about solidarity for green growth, but the climate crisis talks that count on growth are wrong from the start. The current climate crisis is the result of infinite growth for the nation and capital, for power and greed. Even if you put green in front of growth, that's just whitewashing the truth.
P4G, Partnering for Green Growth and Global Goals, links with the UN's 2030 Sustainable Development Goals, which focus on 17 international crises. Urgent action on climate change is number 13. Frank Smith, Seoul.
To work in Afghanistan as a journalist, one needs to be ready for facing horrifying scenarios. From being taken as hostage by the terrorist groups or powerful local commanders to becoming a victim of a blast. It was 4 years ago, on May 31st, that a massive bomb explosion killed or wounded over 600 individuals, mostly civilians. Among the victims was Habibullah Hussein Zadeh, Press TV's cameraman in Kabul.
4 years ago, during the holy month of Ramadan, a major Daesh bomb blast hit the green zone of Kabul. Habib was on his way to the office. Unfortunately, he was killed as he was close to the blast site. We found his dead body in a hospital 6 days later.
The death of Habib was not the first tragic incident for Press TV staff in Kabul. Prior to losing Habib, Press TV Bureau in Kabul had already lost Saeed Farhad Taqaddusi, another cameraman who lost his life after a rocket hit Press TV's office during a complex Taliban attack back in 2011. Saeed Mohsin Husseini remembers how all of his colleagues were shocked when a rocket hit their office in Kabul's heavily protected area.
It was in October 2011 when the Taliban launched a coordinated attack in the heavily protected area of Kabul. One of their rockets hit our office, and we lost our brave cameraman, Sayed Farhad. We are committed to following the footsteps of our martyrs.
Let's not forget that the media groups in Afghanistan are facing many challenges. From the shortage of financial resources to security threats that have forced over 300 journalists and media staff to either quit their jobs or leave the country. Based on official figures, over 133 journalists and media workers in Afghanistan have been killed and many others have been wounded over the past 15 months. According to the 2021 World Press Freedom Index, released by Reporters Without Borders, Afghanistan is still considered one of the most dangerous countries for journalists and reporters around the world. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
In a rare move, Iran's oil ministry has delegated a major oil project to local companies with the aim to boost crude oil production, as U.S. sanctions still cast their shadows on the country's petroleum sector. Worth $1.3 billion, the development project aims to boost the output in the Azadegan oil field to 320,000 barrels per day, up from the existing 140,000 BPDs.
We're running our oil industry amid the U.S. sanctions that seek to destroy the strategic sector. We're not allowed to import a single oil pipe. This is why we have made the greatest achievements during this difficult period. We continue to develop our oil fields to increase our output. We have done it before and we will do it now.
Azadegan oil field is located in southwest Iran and is in the vicinity of Iraq-Iran border. Its in-place oil capacity is estimated to be around 33 billion barrels, but with the current pace, only 1.5 billion barrels are recoverable. In 2009, China's oil giant CNPC won a $2.5 billion deal with Iran's oil ministry to expedite the recovery rate in the oil field. But in 2014, Iran revoked the deal due to China's foot dragging in fulfilling the project. Local firms say the move to handle such a mega project domestically is unprecedented in the history of the oil industry in Iran. In 2018, Iran was the third largest oil producer in the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, following the U.S.'s unilateral withdrawal from the nuclear deal and the reimposition of sanctions in 2018. Iran's oil output almost halved to 1.9 million barrels a day. As a result, Iran's exports have dropped to less than 1 million barrels per day, down from 2.5 million prior to the U.S.'s pullout from the nuclear deal. Now, the signing of these contracts is in line with plans to double oil production to 4.5 billion barrels a day in the next year.
As U.S. oil embargoes are still haunting Iran's crude, Tehran is resorting to domestic firms to keep the strategic sector up and running. Given the vast oil reserves waiting to be tapped into in the Azadegan oil field, experts say the development of the key reservoir means a significant boost to Iran's oil production and a strong comeback to the global market. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello, and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World, and as I say, changed all our tomorrows. The program is dedicated and devoted to the life of Imam Khomeini. May God bless his great soul. We're discussing some very interesting points with my guest, Dr. Hassani, on, you know, why aren't there more Imam Khomeini's. Of course, Islam came to perfect humanity. And there's one very interesting aspect which really is a phenomenon not understood from a materialistic point of view. And I myself personally am witness to this. I didn't know anything about this great man. I never understood anything about this great man. I didn't know one iota of where this man was born.
I hate to say you to this. I have to admit it. We still don't know about so many important things.
Thank you for that, Doctor. I don't wish to
I don't just say that to be humble. Or
no. We genuinely mean that because, yes. As I say, even to this day, why are we having these programs? Because we want to go into depth about a man that perhaps we still know very little or nothing about. But the thing that I wanted to point out was that I was 16 at the time, and the first impact that this gentleman made on me as a teenager was that I was reminded of prophets in the Bible. Mm-hmm. Because I didn't come really from an Islamic background. I came from a more or less a Christian background. And I was impressed by the fact that this is the first time in the 20th century or in a long time, for many generations, that's the first time I've seen a personality that really, really reminded me both of Allah and of his prophets. But the most important thing I felt was love. I felt I had to know this man. I felt I had to leave my home country 4,500 miles away. I may be exaggerating the distance. I don't know. It may be 5,000 miles. It depends on your flight and how you get to Tehran. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, I had to come here. I had to come to the very land, the very country in which this man was born, to find out what was this thing that he placed into my soul, into my heart, that made me love him. Can you explain something about that for me, Dr.
Yes,
Husni?
Yes, honesty.
Honesty.
His honesty.
Yeah. Honesty with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Let's not get sophisticated,
yeah,
complicated.
Sure.
Let's not get entangled with words.
Sure.
He was honest. Ask me with whom.
With whom, yeah.
With himself first.
Exactly.
He knew himself.
And if you know yourself, you know your creator.
And if you know yourself, you know your creator.
Creator.
There's a hadith.
Yes. That's right.
Man arafa nafsa.
Please quote it.
Faqad arafa rabba. But I have to make a point about this.
Please.
Very important and significant tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Because the thing is that unfortunately, mm-hmm, I say this with the bottom of my heart,
mm-hmm,
as a Muslims, we have all the values,
mm-hmm, quite
the sources, the true sources, mm-hmm, of knowing and enjoying the beautiful life that God gave us. But we don't use it to the level. All the traditions, all the, you know, the Quranic verses, we only get a piece of it, maybe the beginning, we forget about the end, or vice versa.
Mm.
And we don't think about that.
Well,
brother, the only difference between us, just like I mentioned in the other program,
sure,
and different creation, different creatures,
mm-hmm,
is the power of thinking in a true sense. This is why Quran, talking about fake, talking about aql, talking about tadabbur, which is different level of thinking. In order to think, you have to become quiet first.
Yes,
you have to become silent. We have a tradition to
that's right.
How can you listen to something if you always talk?
Exactly.
You have to find an isolate place with yourself, which is within yourself.
Yes.
Actually, we're not talking about only material here.
No,
we're not talking about the physical aspect of being alone.
Mm.
You can be in a gathered, but being alone, thinking about your own stuff. And you can be alone, but working with the universe, working with the creation.
Could I just throw something at you, just right there and then, that the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, mentions that if you are in silence, as the silence that you referred to, which is a silence in which to acquire wisdom, do it for 40 days, and it will pour out of you. In other words, we're not alone.
No, we're not.
You're alone with your creator.
Exactly.
Prophet Jesus, peace be upon him, I wanted to quote this from the Bible.
And if you are alone with your creator, you are everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing about the prophets, that I used to read about them in the Bible, that Prophet Jesus, peace be upon him, used to go away for 40 days and 40 nights, as it's quoted in the Bible, alone in the desert. For what? I mean, that's something that, you know, the Christians don't come back with.
As they say, something to think about.
Something to think about. Exactly. And
back
he went
to
do
tradition.
His thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And that was where he poured out as the master, the teacher. When he came back to Jerusalem after those 40 days, that was the wisdom that was being quoted in the book.
He was a different person.
He was a totally different person.
He got the vision.
He got the vision.
When you get the vision, you get the mission. Imam is somebody with special, unique, divine mission. Back to the tradition. Man arafa nafsa.
Yes.
Those who get to know themselves, their true sense, which
yes.
is soul.
Soul.
Faqad arafa rabba. Most surely, they get to know their Lord, their sustainer, who happens to be a creator.
Exactly.
The point about this very significant tradition is this. This tradition is not talking about something about impossible. Because when you're talking about God, you say, oh, you cannot get to know him. Because he is infinite. How can a finite phenomena, thing, material, whatever.
Well, this is what philosophers come up with, isn't it?
Yeah, we're not trying to get philosophical
about it. Yeah.
Not.
No.
This is not the point of this program.
No.
I'm trying to explain it as simple as possible. This is another... If you want to mention it down,
we'll do that.
Imam Khomeini was simple in a true sense.
Yeah.
The same way that Quran is simple. Quran talks to an ordinary person because Quran is, by the way, the book of guidance.
Yes.
Wants to take you from A to B without any damage.
Any damage. Without any... Yeah.
And at the same time, talking to ordinary person, but yet talking to the philosopher, to the historian, to whoever can understand a different level,
exactly.
A deeper one.
Yes.
The point about this tradition, you're not talking about something impossible. Because if you get to know yourself, you get to know your sustainer.
Sustainer.
So the point about it is this. How are you going to get to know yourself? Think about it. I make it simple for you. I'm a weak person. If I know my weakness, the opposite of it, which is not weakness, which is power, which is total might, okay? God Almighty, we say, we claim. You get to know the power of Allah. If you get to know the power of Allah, you are not going to be scared, as simple as that, I put it. If you're not scared of something, so what? You take a step.